This is it. This really is like trying to grow a boat upstream, isn't it? And, the whole form really is a seemingly an attack on our personality and our habits and conditioning in every way. All religion, really, the whole purpose of any religious form is to free the delusion of a separate self. And even though this is sometimes a delusion of a separate self seems to be encouraged in many religions, ultimately the ultimate experience is to relinquish. And this is forgotten as a kind of conventions become doctrinal beliefs and fixed positions. But in Theravada Buddhism it's probably the most clear, because there's not any doctrine that you believe in. Like even a soul or God as a with attributes. All this is not even considered as anything one should attach to in Buddhism. In other religions, God is very much personified and with attributes of goodness and all kinds of lovely qualities, personal qualities. And then the soul is a highly emotive word in the English language. My soul, my heart. This is the soul of this is the center, this is the feeling of life. So the soul, or the emotional body, or the feeling, and then the self, the personality, and all these are reflected as Dhamma, rather as that which arises and ceases. And so it's a pretty strong, relentless approach to the religious life, this one. and that's its directness, isn't it? Ujjupatipanno, it's an incredibly direct, non-cluttered way of doing it. But it is, we really have to determine to do it, because there's a lot of things that we really like and want to hang on to. There's a lot of likable things in the sensory world, in ourselves and in other people, and there's a lot of pleasant, likable, lovely conditions. It's not just the idea of letting them go it brings sorrow and grief. But then that view is always from the self, isn't it? I have to let go of them, I have to get rid of or not be attached. It's still self. That's why it's not a doctrine of you have to let go of everything. It is not a command or an order saying you've got to let go of everything. But to contemplate the result of attachment. And then you, through your own wisdom, then you see the result of the pain, the suffering of attachment, then letting go is a relief. It's rather than a great sacrifice, personal sacrifice, coming from the view that you are somebody who is attached and shouldn't be and has to let go of of all your loved ones and your all the lovely memories, and got to get rid of them, or got to prove that you're not attached by destroying them or whatever, it becomes just another self-view again. The Attakila Makadu Yoko path of annihilation. And notice that even though it's very direct, it's not cruel, or it's not making a demand from above, but it's a pointing, a continuous pointing for you to look and see. If you really, like, say, the attachments you feel, emotional pulls and fascinations still that you still experience, if you really investigate them, look at them for what they are, you realize how much they make you suffer. Because now, don't believe me, I don't think I'm just being a wet blanket. Just trying to say that happiness is misery, when happiness is pure happiness. But if you attach to happiness, and attach to goodness, and attach to beauty, and attach to anything, then it becomes a kind of despair, anxiety, confusion, worry, as a result of that. What is worry anyway? Worry is one of the kind of human, major human sicknesses, isn't it? Everybody worries. These worried looks, miserable expressions and sadness and despair over possibilities of failure or what other people think. How many of you really suffer because you're always worried about that you might have offended somebody, or somebody might think something bad about you? That's a real difficult one, isn't it? To be a human being and then this continuous worry that maybe you've offended somebody, or maybe you've upset somebody, maybe somebody doesn't understand you. Sister Jitta Paula was just in agony because she wanted us to understand her. Please understand me. And wanting us to agree and understand and go along with what she wants to do. Incredibly worried about us, that I wouldn't understand, and terribly disappointed that I didn't agree, and very concerned about the nuns, that they would misunderstand and not agree and not see the importance of what she's doing. And she really suffered here, didn't she? Never saw her look so utterly miserable. And so I feel it too. I want everybody to understand me and agree with me too. I mean, it's not just her. I'm sure all of you would want everybody to understand you. I mean, nobody wants everybody to misunderstand them, do they? Unless you're some kind of very strange creature. But even if you're rebelling and acting obstreperous and a real maverick renegade, that's more just reacting to things. It's still wanting some way to impress people or to be able to thumb your nose. I don't care what you think, they're there. But you do. I mean, if you care or you don't care, it's the same thing. If you say you care or you don't care, that's really the self-view operating. Wanting our parents and close friends to appreciate what we're doing. The sense of somebody, of me, and what I'm doing. So this is investigated as Watch the feeling of it, the in the heart or in the guts, the kind of the sensations, the physical feeling, or the kind of strange feelings one has when one feels worried or anxious or wants somebody to understand, or is you worried maybe that you've offended somebody, or that you've made an offense, like the vinaya. Is a constant kind of, you can endlessly worry about maybe your sanghati faith, or maybe you work quite exactly in hatha-basa with your sanghati in the morning. Maybe it was maybe an inch off. What should you? So you can make this whole thing into an endless kind of, I mean, the rules, the sila, the everything into something more to worry about. That way we can make the holy life into just an enormous burden. Ajahn Chah told a story about one monk who was with him for a while, and he was always worried about the vinaya, the patimokkha discipline and all these rules. Just worried. Couldn't cope with it. So he disrobed and became a samanera, which only 10 rules. And he's still worried about all of those. So then 8 precepts. But he's still worried about that. He thought, better just be a layman. So it took 5 precepts. Several years later, he came to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah said, "Well, how are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm not keeping 5 precepts anymore. I don't worry about anything now." I hunt and fish and drink and... So... there's that alternative. They just throw it all out the window and just do what you want. Or how to skillfully use these things and watch worry. If you're worried about the vinaya, worried about the rules, and worried about what people think, and this is because of avicca bhajya sangha, not because of rules or because anything's wrong with anything other than you're coming from the sense of a me and mine, an assumption of a self. So this opportunity to see that, I mean, you aren't going to, even if you manage to disrobe and throw away all the rules and just do what you want, you're still going to be plagued by worries, aren't you? My worry is that, you know, you might be able to not, you might think you're not worried, but in moments when you're not hunting, fishing and drinking, and you're left alone with yourself, your mind is going to have a real rebound, blast, explosion. To observe it, while, because there's nothing to worry about. I'm not trying to cause you any worry, am I? At least I have no intention to make you worry about anything. I don't have any. What I say might make you worry, but that's not my intention. But to use that experience of worry to really investigate it, the feeling of it. Don't analyze yourself or come from the top position like, I shouldn't worry. If I had real faith in the Dhamma, I wouldn't worry. But I don't have real faith because I still worry a lot about everything. And that kind of thinking is really misleading. Isn't it? It's still the assumption that I'm somebody that should be something else. I shouldn't worry, and I should have complete faith in the Dhamma. All that is believing and grasping ideas, ideals. So when there is worry, anxiety, fear, And you recognize it, you know, you actually admit to yourself, oh, I'm really worried. I'm really worried about what people think of me. And it's like an alcoholic suddenly admitting, yes, I'm an alcoholic. It's something in you has is willing to confess it, to say this, not as a fixed position of I am a worrier, as a kind of another assumption to make as if that was all you ever do, but it's the recognition of a problem, of an unpleasant thing that you might have just been dismissing or suppressing, ignoring. And then you go, really worry then. If you're a worry, then really find everything you can to worry about. The sky might fall in, the bird might drop excrement on you when you're walking under a tree. A lot of airplanes flying over here, Luton Airport, they might crash down. Tony Kessler might come back and set the place on fire. And find out and see how much you can really worry, but do it deliberately, you know, determined to really worry with full determination. Worry about the rules. Make sure that every rule in the Patimokkha you worry about. Don't just kind of dismiss your worries and I shouldn't worry about it. But if you're going to worry, then do it quite resolutely and wholeheartedly and watch it. And think, what does it feel like to be caught in it? What is it? How does it affect your body to be in a state of worry? How do you feel in your gut? What do your guts feel like in the state of tension or stress and worry, anxious feeling? What does it feel like here? So you investigate it rather than just think, oh, I shouldn't be worried. I don't have to make it because everything's all right. If you're angry, then say, well, really, really, if you're going to be angry, don't be dismissive, but really hate. See how much you can really hate with full intention. And what does hatred feel like? So you're really looking directly at it and making yourself do this rather than just kind of reacting and dismissing and then feeling guilty and then trying to get away from it and distract yourself and then feeling confused and uncertain about everything. With a monastic life, if you feel really angry or averse or bring it into your mind. I hate this. I don't want to be a monk. One of those stupid bhikkhus, you know, those awful Sila Dharas and that big fat Ajahn Sumedho. Get as nasty as you can and really listen to it so that the negativity is really observed. If you're going to be negative and angry, do it very intentionally, deliberately. Not with spite to hurt anyone, but just to observe what it is. Because this life is intimidating. You think, well, I should only feel great respect for Ajahn Sumedho after all he's done for me and helped so many people and such a nice man and blah 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 blah. And then maybe you're really angry or averse or just being bloody minded and critical and you're trying to feeling guilty about it. But then really I've done it. I know what I'm talking about and it really helps you to see clearly what it is. Or if you're just coming from, oh, I shouldn't feel like that, you know, then you just caught in this kind of nebulous guilt state, and And you just go around in this kind of painful confusion of your mind. Dreary confusion, because you're, you know, all of us are pretty good-hearted types of people, aren't we? We don't want to be hateful and worried and ungrateful, and we don't, and a teacher that you respect most of the time, or like, or love, and then you don't want to admit that you think that you feel terrible, if you feel anger or aversion or resentment towards me or the monks or the nuns or whatever, then you, and so then you just get confused by it. Because your idea that I shouldn't feel like this, that's all they've done, they've committed themselves to the holy life, and blah, 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 blah. And then you're feeling guilty about anger and hatred and bitterness. If you're grumbling and complaining person, then really do it quite intently, rather than try not to be a grumbler and dismiss it. Really grumble about everything, but listen to it. Listen to it. Grumble, 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 whinge, whinge, whinge. Really do it. Listen to it, though. What does it feel like to be in that, yeah, kind of continuous grumbling state of mind? Say, do I really want to be like this? Ask myself at what my poem I first read, because I grumbled a lot and kept grumbling. Then one day I was sitting and thought, do I want to be like this? Do I want to spend the rest of my life grumbling about everything? No. It's really horrible to be caught in that aramana. There's habit, habitual kind of mental state. That's with idealism, that's the problem with idealistic people, is that they attach to such high-minded views that they have no way of relating and dealing with the practicalities of existence, other than grumbling, complaining about or feeling guilty about themselves, complaining about others and feeling guilty themselves. That's a result of being attached to high-mindedness. Which high-minded ideals are, if there's wisdom, then they're beautiful kind of guidelines, points, or stars to aim at, not measures, the highest measures, to judge life's experiences from at every moment. It would be silly of me to compare every moment with a beautiful star. I'm a beautiful star in the sky, and I look at this star and got the beautiful star in my head. What have you come to see me and compared to a beautiful star, you're pretty crude. Not very beautiful. Get out of here. With Vinaya, see it as a tool to use rather than as a whole lot of rules that you have to keep and feel and fret and make a burden about. See it as a as something to develop and to use for restraint, and not to judge yourself with, or make into kind of a legal system of a kind of judgments from above. Thou shalt be with thy sankati, the three robes at dawn. Kind of these very grave announcements to us from the Patimokkha discipline makes it into into something to worry about. To have respect for it and train yourself with it takes mindfulness and wisdom. But if you're conditioning yourself just out of that kind of mental state of fear and intimidation, then, and you don't see what you're doing, then you're not going to get a very large result. You're going to be quite miserable and burdened by monasticism. But if you know how to take the monastic form with wisdom and how to use them with joy and really, you know, like developing a joyful life within a beautiful form. And it's not like living a life of suppressed restriction under a lot of rules in which you might fail, you might, you know, and this would just make the life of a Buddhist monk a very unpleasant, impossible thing to carry on for very long. It's like asceticism, it's too much, isn't it? Too much restraint or pain in that to live. You don't want to fast for, you know, for very long, or maybe one likes to try to see how tough one is, so maybe you go without sleep, or you don't eat sweet things, or you fast, or you get you try to deny yourself all the things that are comfortable and pleasant, and maybe that's a good way to practice sometimes, just to see what happens. But as a way you want to live your life, just a life of denial and miserable discomfort, is certainly not what the Buddha had in mind. One thing became very apparent to me was that Buddhist monasticism was a very pleasant way to live, and you could easily live it your whole life. It wasn't asking me to be miserable and uncomfortable and suppress everything for a lifetime, because then when I first started it, that's what I thought I had to do, because my mind was conditioned in that way, to see any form of rule or restriction as some kind of torture. But then in the living of the life, one began to appreciate its quality and its beauty, and one could see it as a way to that one could really enjoy living one's lifetime. Not as some kind of supreme sacrifice, in that kind of, you know, dedicating my life to myself to being living in a very restricted way out of fear or masochism, but it has its own. Now, when people say to me, "Oh, you monks must be very difficult to not be able to eat in the evening, to be celibate, to do this, not have money," well, that makes people feel sorry for it. And when they do it, it surprises me, because I don't find any of that unpleasant. Very relieved, actually. Celibacy is a very peaceful life, not a not a, an unpleasant life, or just the quality of a life of restraint in practicing Dhamma has its grace and its beauty that might not be visible to layperson who thinks they couldn't get along without their television, their stereo, their pleasures, their holidays, their all the things that become necessities for people's ordinary lives. Wat Pa Phong, I remember going through real hate theory where I hated the time. Did you ever do that?
No. Need it for this president, quite directly.
And this looking at everything with aversion. But then really, then determining if I'm going to hate it, to really do it fully, consciously, totally. And then it you have to get a perspective on it. It's not, because if you don't do that, then you tend to, it's a kind of furtiveness of the mind where you kind of go between, I hate this place and I shouldn't feel like that. So you kind of feel guilty and then you try to kind of suppress it, kind of. Then you feel, get into a kind of grayness of mind, where, because you can't admit anything or really let go of anything, it all kind of accumulates in a kind of sludge, emotional sludge. Also, I'd bring up, trying to think of what am I most frightened of in life, or what am I most, you know, if there are latent desires and forces operating in me, what are the worst possible things they could be? What could, maybe I'm a killer or a... what is the worst possible thing you could ever be, or what do you find maybe perversely attractive or fascinating, or all this kind of just questioning to bring into consciousness things that are, once you allow something into consciousness, then it's accepted and it can cease. So you're actually freeing the mind. And this is where a lot of people, very high-minded people, have their greatest problems, because they can't do that. They're always so frightened of maybe the suppressed feeling or bitterness or whatever, so that they can't just look at these things in full consciousness. When you can do that, then it's like you're purifying the mind. It looks like sometimes you're really making your mind dirty, but it's not. You're actually bringing, to clean something, you have to look at the dirt and say, this is dirt. Well, yeah, if you're going to clean the house, you have to look for the dirt. Not go around and saying, there's no dirt here. Or if you see a bit, you're going to sweep it under the carpet. And sometimes I noticed I could use this kind of vision where if you didn't really want to face something, you could kind of squint your eyes, take off your glasses, and things don't, you can't see in gross details, in particular. Some people go through life like that, they kind of blur. But like when you're looking at the dirt, you're not saying I'm dirty. Then you're not really looking at it. You're just saying there shouldn't be any dirt, but there is, you know. And because there is, then I'm dirty, which is from ignorance, isn't it? The false kind of logic you're working with. So that the dirt is, it just seems dirt. Don't make anything out of it. This is what it is, and then you can sweep it away, let it go. But if you're identifying with it, then you've got it all wrong, and you can't really let it go then. You more or less sweep it under the carpet. This is where it's important to, you see, the pure, the true nature of things is pure and right. I mean, it's nothing to be frightened of, really. I mean, what you think you might be, or all the possibilities of horrible things and becoming something horrible or going crazy or whatever is just the fabrication of the mind out of the avijja. It's not the way things are. It's not your true nature. So that's why there's nothing really to be afraid of. When you see Dhamma, from the self view, then there's always a lot. There's a lot to be afraid of from being a person, and from being attached to mortality, because mortality, you know, bodies can always be hurt, and people can always be offended and insulted, that's just life, isn't it? There's so much of that all the time in society. If somebody brutalizing somebody else, or offending, or insulting, or despising, or exploiting. When has there been a time in history where that has never happened? And then we can get diseases, we can be attacked, raped, butchered, mutilated. It's all possible, isn't it? As physical bodies, there is a lot to worry about. You go down parts of London, or plane go over to Lebanon or something, your body is definitely going to be, can be abused. And then you go to rough parts of London, New York City, you can count on being beaten up, raped or whatever. So if you're identified with the body, then there's a lot to worry about. It's not being neurotic even. There is a lot to worry about on the mortal plane. If that's what reality is and that's what you are, then your life is going to be a worry. Because that's just the way that the conditioned realm is. There's a lot to worry about in it as a person. And as a physical being. But the animal realm is frightened, isn't it? animals are frightened creatures. They always have to be on the lookout because there's Doris and there's tiger and then there's dogs and you just contemplate these sweet pussy cats. But if you're a little mouse, you would never perceive them as sweet, gentle, soft, lovable creatures. You look at the tiger looking that glaring at you, ready to swallow you alive. Nothing sweet or lovable about that. But because we're bigger than they are, isn't it? It's relative, because I'm bigger than tiger. She couldn't swallow me whole. So the animal kingdom is a realm of fear. Wild animals, if you notice, the alertness, this instinctual self-preservation is an absolute necessity for survival on that instinctual plane. We have the same instinctual nature as the animals. One thing that our instinctual nature is any kind of more elevated than theirs, it's exactly the same thing. But the human realm, they have this, it can realize the transcendence, the immortal. So then there's nothing to fear. But on the condition plane, human beings have the ability to make laws and agreements that the animals can't make. So we can have police officers and law enforcement bodies and armies and so forth, and decide on keeping laws and punish people who don't keep the laws. We can do that. Animals can't. Only in children's stories do you see rabbits and foxes sitting down at a table together and agreeing to love each other. But in reality of life in the jungle, rabbits and foxes can't do that. No way can they have a tea party together without the rabbit being attacked. But in this realm, it is fear, and instinctual fear is a normal feeling. Like if a bear is chasing you, or a man with an axe is running after you, I mean, that kind of fear is not kilesa. It's instinctual, not personal, not a person. It's totally impersonal. Then the fearlessness comes through understanding Dhamma and your own determination. Like we can determine not to kill the rabbits and that kind of thing. We can choose. We can say bana dibata veramini and determine not to harm other creatures. But animals can't do that. When tiger kills a mouse, that's not immoral. That's not an immoral act for her. Because that's just her nature. If you can't apply moral human morality to the animal kingdom because it's not fair to them. When a cat kills a mouse, that's their nature. There's nothing immoral in that act at all. But it is immoral for us if we know better. If we don't know any better, it's not immoral. But because we know better, then it's an immoral act to kill. But if it's people that don't know any better, it's not. It's not an absolute. So in one way, not having rules or not knowing very much, you don't have you know, if you can just live on a more instinctual plane, sometimes, you know, I suppose there's a lot of fear on that plane, but at least you don't have the niggling guilt problems and refined neurotic hang-ups that the more intelligent and reflective you become. you can get very complicated. But also, it's the way out of suffering, using intelligence and with wisdom, and using our sensitivity to becoming very sensitive, and using intelligence with wisdom and mindfulness. And it's a miracle, it's a great gift. It's a beautiful opportunity we have, rather than a burden and a continuous torture and worry for it. Which, for many people, that's all life is for them, is just an endless worry, burden of life. Especially as you get older in ignorance. Imagine them being my age. I think if I hadn't practiced Dhamma, I like to meet men my own age and contemplate, well, where are they? You know, if you're 55, what is the result of your life? They're living 55 years. And for a lot of men, 55, life at 55 is really horrible. Because now you're old at 55 as far as work goes, and they're trying to retire you, get rid of you at 50. So you're in one way you have, you know, if you haven't any other resources other than just money and work and profession or family, then it can be a pretty miserable, burdensome age to be. They say that's where men often, most men commit suicide. Is the majority of suicide among men around in the 50s. Because life suddenly, there's nothing more, there's no meaning to it. You, when you're younger, you can have the idea of getting somewhere and attaining something and achieving something, maybe a profession, some career. But by the time you're 55, you haven't made it. Or even if you have. Even if you have made it, it's pretty disappointing. So, if you don't have Dhamma and don't have anything other than merely a conditioned life and attachment to the conditioned world, then life gets more and more burdensome and despairing and dreary as you get older. But as a experience of Dhamma, then getting older is Dhamma for you. You find it something you take an interest in. I'm interested in getting older. I find it interesting and good Dhamma to watch my body get older and to just observe the changes and the advantages of getting older and things like this. So the process of aging in that is not taken from vanity, you know, or aversion to the fact that maybe the aging process, the body isn't as nice as it was when it was younger, or isn't as attractive, or isn't as vigorous, or isn't as energetic as it was. But then, as Dhamma, that's even an advantage, isn't it? To not have it, these burning fires scorching you all the time. Old age is a little calmer and cooler, but physically it is.